WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Many of the stereotypes about women's strength, stamina, and competitive drive are challenged by women athletes who are making inroads into male-dominated sports. In 1995, Anna Seton Huntington was a member of the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup, the world's premier sailing race. She says America's Cup racing has been cloistered inside the elite, clubby, wholly male-dominated world of yacht clubs. And in most of those clubs, women's official roles are often limited to fashion shows and girls' nights out. Huntington has written a new memoir about her experiences on the women's team called Making Waves. I asked her how the women's team was started.
The women's team was a brainstorm of Bill Cokes. He was the person who won the America's Cup in 1992, a very wealthy man who'd taken up sailing late in life, and he's kind of got a knack for coming into things and shaking them up. And he wanted to field a women's team because he felt like it was time for women to have a chance in the sport. And I think he also felt like he'd like to see the old guard squirm a little bit. And so he started planning and putting together a crew in the fall of 1993, actually.
How did you end up on the women's team?
I ended up on the women's team because I had been an Olympic rower, and I'd gotten a bronze medal in 1992. And there's a long tradition of among the men of rowers being brought on board to be grinders, which is a position that requires a lot of strength and endurance, which rowers have, but doesn't necessarily require a lot of sailing knowledge. It's something that you can sort of pick up along the way.
So what does a grinder do?
The grinder, if anyone's seen the America's Cup on television, it's the person who's sort of hunched over a waist-high pedestal, turning what appears to be bicycle pedals with her hands. And the handles are mechanically attached to the winches on the boats, and the winches draw in the lines that raise the sails and also move them from side to side, which is something that's constantly happening during the course of a four-hour race.
In your book, Making Waves, you write that when you joined the women's team, you had a vision of fighting a battle on behalf of all women, and that you imagined a team propelled by a collective vision of creating opportunities and changing perceptions, but that's not what you found. What did you find?
I guess I found a group of women who were much more interested in sort of immersing themselves in a sailing experience and perhaps in furthering themselves or their careers as sailors. They were not necessarily interested in how our efforts might pay off for the future, although that was, you know, sort of a bonus, I think, but from many people's perspective. But it certainly wasn't most people's purpose for being there. The general sense was that, you know, we're athletes, not feminists.
You say that the women on the team favored teamwork over hierarchy. In fact, they even eliminated the skipper position.
Yeah, well, actually, those were ethics that were given to us by the coaches. The coaches thought that they would eliminate the skipper's position, which is a position that's, you know, kind of generated through centuries of maritime tradition. It's a position on the boat that It's pretty necessary. I mean, you have an intense competitive environment. You have chaos in terms of noise and lines and sails and 16 people doing all different things. And you really need that one voice of authority to be able to rise above it all and catch everyone's attention. But the assumption that our coaches made was that, well, they're women and they will get along better by consensus or operating by committee than they will operating by hierarchy. So they decided to remove the skipper's position and just sort of give us this nebulous system for operating as a group.
So how did that work out?
It was actually fairly disastrous for us. Because it impeded the development of leadership among us. What ended up happening was that there were two women in the back of the boat, Leslie Egnott and J.J. Eisler, who carried most of the burden for making decisions. And because neither one of them had been designated the skipper and neither one of them, neither one of them felt comfortable saying, you know, I should be the skipper, even though the coaches have said we shouldn't have a skipper. Those two were just locked in a battle for control. And so often, you know, they were on the boat in racing situations needing to make split-second decisions and being forced to sort of have discussions about what they thought was right instead of one person being able to snap her fingers and say, you know, we're going left here. So what ended up happening is that, I guess, simply put, we just ended up developing a leadership gap in the back of the boat. And a little more than halfway through the racing, the coaches who were frustrated with the lack of leadership, despite the fact that I think they were largely responsible for it, they decided to remove J.J. Eisler, who was a tactician, and replace her with David Dellenbaugh, who had been the tactician on the 1992 team. And so that was, you know, in essence, that was the end of the women's team.
It's a difficult spot to be in when you're new to a sport or to a field because, you know, you want to be independent and everything. On the other hand, you don't have a lot of experience because you haven't been allowed in there before. So it's a problem. You want to be able to do it all. On the other hand, you're not nearly as experienced as the people who have years and generations, you know, of insiderness.
That's true. We were absolutely dependent on the men who were coaching and managing us, even though our professed goal was to win as a group of women and to sort of make a statement about women's abilities. We had just by the nature of things, I guess in some ways it was a catch-22. We were absolutely dependent on the men to teach us the basics of sailing and to a certain extent lead us through our first experience out there racing against other men who had decades of America's Cup experience under their belt. Although I guess I felt like there was room at a certain point for our coaches and managers to hand us the reins or for us to take them out of their hands one way or the other. And I think that if that was something that had been planned early on, it might actually have happened.
Your boat didn't have a skipper because the male management thought that you'd be better off with teamwork than hierarchy. Do you think that women on the boat would have been uncomfortable giving orders or taking orders?
I think that we had, among us, we had women, you know, for example, J.J. Eisler, who had years of skippering experience. In fact, she'd been in match races skippering boats of men, and she was used to giving orders. It was something that came pretty naturally to her. We also had Don Riley, who had raced around the world twice and skippered. In one of those cases, she had skippered the boat in the Whitbread race. So I don't think that it was any inherent lack of comfort with being in charge of things. What I think happened was largely that there was this sort of edict from above, from our coaches, that teamwork was what was going to get us across the finish line first. And so there was a real effort at all times to display our ability to work together. And in fact, a handful of very qualified women had been cut right off the bat when they were putting the team roster together. And I think they were cut in large part because their personalities didn't really appear to fit in. They appeared to be too bossy and too controlling. And so when women who had, you know, Olympic gold medals or had been Rolex yachtswomen of the year, when women with those kind of credentials got cut, I think it was a real red flag to people to focus on teamwork and to sort of, demonstrate their ability to get along, not necessarily to assert their ego.
One of your male opponents referred to your boat as the lesbo boat. What was the reaction of the women on the team to that?
Yeah, Dennis Connor, who is sort of Mr. America's Cup himself, he's been in 7 America's Cup races and won 4 of them, and we had a pretty lively relationship with Dennis. He was not altogether welcoming of our team, and he at a cocktail party, actually, he referred to one of the women on our team. He didn't want his wife talking to her, and he said, don't talk to her because she's on the lesbo boat. And at that point, Annie Nelson, the woman on our team, looked up, and somebody said, "Oh, Annie, don't take that from him." And she said, "Okay, I won't." And she dumped her rum and coke on his head. And I guess in some ways, although all of that Dennis denies, but in some ways, I think it had a real galvanizing effect on our team. It was a real kind of in-your-face move on Annie's part, and I think it just gave us a sense that Dennis was scared of us in a way.
It sounds from your book that after that comment, there was an attempt to prove we are heterosexual. People were like enumerating the number of married people on board, the number of, of women with children, and
That's something that a desire to prove our heterosexuality was something that was there sort of right from the start with the marketing of our team. I think there was a great deal of concern about us coming across as anything but wives or potential wives or mothers or whatever, that they, no one on our team and no one marketing our team, or very few, wanted to risk being associated with anything with lesbianism, or didn't want to risk the perception that there might be a lesbian aboard our boat. And I guess my sense was that was all so beside the point, and that, so what if there were lesbians on our team? It didn't affect our ability to prove women have a right to be competing in the America's Cup. I just didn't see what the connection was. And I felt in some ways like it was such a holdover from the past. It was such a dug up insult. People have been dismissing female athletes for decades, saying that they're lesbians. So I found it particularly uncreative and also just sort of irrelevant.
My guest is Anna Seton Huntington. In 1995, she was a member of the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup, the world's premier sailing race. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anna Huntington, her new book, Making Waves, is about her experiences on the first women's team to compete for the America's Cup. How did you do in the final race?
The very last race was against Dennis Connor, and it was a race where if he won, he would then go on to the America's Cup against Team New Zealand, and if we won, we would have one last race against the other U.S. team packed. And that race would then decide which of us would go on to the final America's Cup. And so it was a do-or-die race. And the race is 18 miles long. It's six legs and six three-mile legs. And we actually led for the first 5 legs and developed an enormous margin over Dennis, in large part because the wind was so light and just sort of dying the whole day. And So the boats just spread further and further apart. And in fact, when we came around the last buoy and headed for home, ESPN, who was covering the race, cut away because they were so convinced that there was no chance for us to get beaten, that there was no chance for Dennis to make a comeback. And they cut away to spring training or something. And we came around the buoy and went over to one side of the course, and Dennis came around the buoy and went over to the other side. And as can happen in sailboat racing, the wind just sort of, you know, unfortunately or magically, you know, from his perspective, probably followed him down the course and left us in a big hole. And he managed to get a lead over our boat and ultimately eventually win the race.
So did you feel like very defeated knowing that you were close to winning and then lost? Did it make losing even harder?
I guess, actually, I'd say no, it didn't. I think that we knew that we were so close, and we knew that we'd almost taken it from the master of the game. And I think it gave all of us a sense more than, you know, initially, yeah, there was a sense of tragedy, but I think probably in the long run, it gave all of us more of a sense that we almost had it. We really almost did do it. And so I think having been so close, yeah, it might have made it hurt more, but it gave us a sense of our own abilities, I think, also.
Are you still sailing or rowing?
My husband and I have a sailboat, and we sail on that. And we also have a 7-month-old son, so it's recreational activities seem to be sort of limited at the moment. But I do look forward to a day when I take him out in the sailboat.
So you got pregnant shortly after the race?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So you went from one physical thing to a very different physical experience.
Yeah, it's true. That was absolutely a mind-boggling experience, kind of letting go of control of my body.
Right, and yes, exactly. Every muscle must be tight.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So did you work out while you were pregnant?
I started out with these plans of, you know, emerging from pregnancy in better shape than I had gone in and all of this stuff. And, you know, I'd say probably my third month I made it to the Y to swim maybe once or twice and put on the standard 40 pounds. And, you know, you're in the back seat when you're pregnant. Mother Nature just takes over. And it was a real different experience for me as an athlete, just feeling like I had to let go and go along for the ride.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, Terry, thank you very much.
Anna Seton Huntington is the author of Making Waves.